Welcome to the Data Exchange Podcast. I'm your host, Ben Lorica. Before we start today's episode, a few quick reminders. You can find episode notes on our website, thedataexchange.media. We now have an active YouTube channel where we have video versions of recent podcast episodes, including this one. Go to gradientflow.com/subscribe for details on how to subscribe to our YouTube channel and to our newsletter. Finally, please subscribe and rate us through Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or TuneIn.com or Spotify. And thanks so much for your continued support. Now to this week's episode. This week's guests are Raed Ghani, who is a distinguished career professor in the machine learning department at Carnegie Mellon University and also at the Heinz College of Information Systems and Public Policy, also at Carnegie Mellon University. And we also have my good friend Andrew Burt, who is a recurring guest on this podcast. And as many of you may recall, Andrew is the co-founder and managing partner at BNH.AI, a new law firm focused on AI compliance, risk mitigation, and related topics. So this week, we discussed a range of topics, including how companies are addressing bias and fairness in machine learning and statistical modeling. And we also briefly discussed one of Raed's projects, Aquitas, which is an open source bias audit toolkit for machine learning developers, analysts, and policymakers. We also touched on other aspects of responsible AI, including explainability and interpretability, privacy, and safety and reliability. And Raed is also active in the use of machine learning and data science in public policy. So we also discuss what's going on at the intersection of those topics. So a quick announcement, we have two new surveys that will be released very shortly. The first is the NLP Industry Survey, and the second one is the Data Engineering Survey. Subscribe to our newsletter at gradientflow.com/subscribe, and we'll notify you when these surveys are available for free download. I hope you enjoyed this episode. So we have Raed Ghani, distinguished career professor in the ML department, as well as the Heinz College of Information Systems and Public Policy, both at Carnegie Mellon University. And our regular guest here, Andrew Burt, who is the co-founder and managing partner of BNH AI. Welcome both to the Data Exchange Podcast.
Thanks.
Thank you so much. Great to be back.
So today, I'd like to get both of your perspectives on two areas in responsible AI. I also would like to learn more about what Raed is doing in terms of applying ML to public policy. But first, so responsible AI. So the first area I wanted to talk to you both about is fairness and bias. So last year, I came across a study which kind of indicated that many organizations are thinking about this, but they're much more in a reactive mode. So in other words, we'll do something when something bad happens. So what is your sense of what's happening now today in terms of just organizations in general? And Raed, we can start with you in terms of the practicality of some of the tools available out there.
I think I'd say largely, and you know, Andrew is more on the ground, a lot of these things, but largely I think most organizations are still reactive, right? They're reacting after something has happened and trying to change their organizational setup and practices as a result of that. But it's, and that's not new. I mean, in every area as humans, we're generally pretty reactive, right? When something bad happens, we try to fix things. We do that in public policy all the time. We wait until somebody gets sick and then we try to treat them. We wait until somebody, you know, doesn't finish high school. We try to figure out what to do. Somebody gets unemployed, somebody gets homeless. So I think a lot of public policy today is designed just is reactive because it's more efficient. It's cheaper to sort of in the near term, but it has equity impacts in the long term. So I think we're at a point where people are thinking about a lot of the fairness and bias in these types of systems. Some of the more progressive ones are looking ahead and trying to get ready for what's to do the right thing.
If you do want to be proactive, are the tools there for you to be proactive?
Not entirely. I think they're being built. But I think a lot of the research community in this space is kind of detached from real world use cases and real problems and real data and real people who are impacted by these problems. So a lot of people who are doing this research are kind of coming in from a theoretical side, their practical needs on the ground. And what's starting to happen is those fields are coming together. And I think that's kind of what's needed. So I don't think the tools are there, but I also think, I don't think the methodology is there. I don't think those companies know what they want. They don't know what does fairness mean? And how to elicit that and how to define that and then mapping that to kind of operational requirements. So I don't think we're there yet, but I think we're moving towards that.
I know that Andrew has lamented to me privately that a lot of the teams that they work with are still somewhat resistant, actually, right?
Yeah. And I think I want to jump in and both sing Raed's praises and then also offer some commentary. And so in terms of tools, Raed has spearheaded and built a very, 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 I think, good, powerful open source tool that I might mispronounce, but Aquitas, which is available and ready and has been used. So I would just say that that exists. I would also say one of the reasons why it's wonderful to work with Raed is because a lot of the way these issues are tackled in the research community seems to be in a vacuum where it becomes very hard to translate. How do you actually solve these issues in the real world for practitioners? That problem actually gets compounded because there are all these legal considerations, and a lot of the tools out there sound really good, but they actually can do things that are actually will get people into trouble. So there are all sorts of reasons why this really amazing work that's being done in the research community has a hard time filtering down. So there are lots of challenges. But that being said, I want to make it clear to everyone listening, there are like a million things you can do right now that can help make an impact, even if you find yourself in an organization that's being reactive.
I guess one of the things I've noticed in this space, Raed, is that, you know how in the different parts of the ML pipeline, you have identifiable open source projects, right? So you PyTorch, TensorFlow for training, right? So scikit-learn. For serving, you're starting to have some of these tools as well. In the fairness space, it seems like there's a hodgepodge of researchy open source projects. So it's a bit confusing for teams unless they either one, devote a lot of time researching each of these tools or roll their own, right? So there's no emergent simple set of tools, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think part of it is because of just the maturity of this area. Even if you go to ML, I would argue there aren't good toolkits for the entire pipeline.
Not yet.
There are toolkits to build models.
Yeah.
And that's 90% of these you mentioned, TensorFlow, PyTorch, scikit-learn. 90% of the time, they just build models. That's easy. It's two lines of code. And that's not the hard part. It's everything else around it. Like, what models should you be building? How do you generate? How do you validate these models? What metrics to use? How do you deploy them? How do you monitor them? How do you think about explaining these things? How do you think about bias and fairness? Those are the tough questions. So
in those areas, they're starting to be startups.
That's right.
Right. So, but in the kind of the fairness and bias space, it seems like there's a lot of interest in, I hate to use the phrase, virtue signaling.
Yeah.
Around it. But then in terms of someone devoting time to it, right? So Raed, is it a stretch to say that someone can still make a name for themselves if they kind of build a lot of capabilities around this area, right?
So I mean, you could make it's a critical need for today. It's a critical need for society and the world. I would want this to be a critical need for every business and every organization that is using data in any form. Part of that means, trying to figure out how to, because I think one thing that sort of Andrew was, or you were also mentioning is that resistance, that pushback. And part of this is we assume, like most talks I hear about bias and fairness and machine learning and AI, in the first couple of minutes, we'll use the word trade-off. And we actually don't know empirically if there is a trade-off. We're sort of assuming that you're going to lose business value. You're going to lose accuracy if you care about bias. And actually, it turns out we have some work we've been doing where we're finding for a large class of problems, there is no trade-off empirically. Theoretically, there are lots of things, but when you actually empirically apply these methods, there is no trade-off in a lot of cases. So we should question that assumption. Even if I'm a business, I'm not giving up value, I'm not giving up, revenue because I want to do the responsible and the right thing. And I think that's a big gap right now.
And it's also the umbrella term fairness actually covers the entire pipeline in some ways, right? So from data prep and
our formulation, how you formulate the problem.
Andrew, what I was getting at is,
in different parts of the data and ML stack, you've got so many people working on the same problem again and again, you know, like a time series database, streaming solutions and stuff like that. Here, I'm trying to encourage our data engineering audience or infrastructure people in the audience to maybe this is an area that you can also devote some of your technical skills. I mean, you would have to work with people like Raid and Andrew to get a feel for what it is that needs to be built. But I think there's still a lot of opportunity for people who have the right skills to make an impact, right?
I mean, and apologies in advance to anyone who has to work with us. But I think what we have seen and what I've seen from my perspective over the years is that AI is surrounded by an enormous amount of hype. Like, it's crazy. Like, you say AI and then suddenly people want to do it, even if the same thing no one wanted to do before there was AI, and there's investors and it's sexy and there's all this stuff. And so we're in a world where lots of different organizations are embracing AI in one way or another for marketing purposes, for actual technical purposes. And I think collectively, different parts of society are waking up to the fact that risk is now the most important part of AI, in the sense that if the AI is too risky, you can't use it. And so the resistance that you talked about, Ben, we see it all over the place, which is basically different groups realizing kind of, oh crap, legal is standing in the way of deployment, or, you know, a risk assessment is standing in the way of deployment. But my job is not to focus on risk. My job is to make a model as quickly as possible and as accurate as possible and then push it to production. And so there's this huge challenge. And I think it's an insane opportunity because we see it in almost every organization that is using AI one way or another. Legal, risk, security, folks under the CISO are all finding themselves very awkwardly kind of thrown in front of these AI efforts and being told, think about the risks. And there's a real shortage of people who are equipped to do it. So I think it's an opportunity. And come join us.
So as Raid alluded to, some, you know, one of the challenges is it's hard to sometimes formulate the problem in a way that you can tackle it more comprehensively, right? So, but I'm just reminded of some of the infrastructure people out here in Silicon Valley, right? So where, I guess these days you have this notion of platform engineering and front-end engineering, right? So maybe this fairness question, Andrew and Raid, if some of the platform engineering people can contribute, then maybe there's some set of tools that just come out of the box for a team that they can at least start with, right?
I'm just going to make one point about what it is we mean when we say fairness, because one of the things that we have seen is that traditionally when you say fairness, a lot of data scientists tune out. That's not my job. That's ambiguous. I deal with code, you know?
So this is kind of what I'm alluding to is maybe if there's a platform team that takes care of a little bit of that, then they can tune out.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're seeing some teams, you know, ML trust team types of stuff like that get stood up. But I think the really important point to make, because I want folks who are listening not to think that fairness is foreign, which is that there's a concept we talk a lot about. We call it differential validity, but you can also think of fairness as a form of accuracy. So you're just thinking about how accurate is my system for specific groups, for protected groups, sensitive groups of people. And so there is also a world where rather than this as being a separate team, this is just kind of a more expansive way of doing what data scientists already do. And it doesn't surprise me that, but it doesn't surprise me that much that there's not an empirical trade-off, because if you think about fairness through this differential validity context, it actually might make sense where if something is better at being fair, it might actually be more accurate.
No, and I think that's exactly right, right? Is fairness is not, as I said, it's not an orthogonal goal. Like, fairness is very much a measure of model quality, system performance. And instead of having a fairness team or a fairness tool, it needs to be model or system quality team that's focused on it, right? Because it's not as if you build something and then you hand it over to the fairness people and then they do something to it. And just to put, you know, my people on the line, I think a big gap is because of training that we're providing people in this space. We are not providing them the training in academia, in industry, in general. You know, every ML person who gets trained, the first few metrics they think about optimizing are basically efficiency metrics. I want to get the most things right. I want to get the most people correct. And that's efficiency. So somehow we're just saying ML is efficiency. And I have to often sort of get people out of that and say, well, who decided everybody is equal? You do other things, right? In ML, where you give different costs to different types of people. And oh yeah, so why are you starting with that? And I think that's a flaw in our training process, because it just gets so embedded in people's view of what ML is.
But even Raid, to some extent, even ML research, right? Because if you look at the benchmarks, they're just benchmarks. There's nothing fairness. There's no fairness in there.
That's right. And the metric is, again, in most of the benchmarks, the metric is, you know, AUC or accuracy or something useless that in the real world you would never use for anything. But it has nothing. It's, again, assuming that the majority group is what you care about getting right. And that's a very fundamental assumption, that we should question the values of the system. And that's a train. Again, that's the flaw of a field. And I'm hoping that, you know, these types of conversations and these types of, you know, the discussions, public discussions are changing that, to say, no. Why are we picking this metric? Who came up with this metric? Who, you know, we have lots of the infinite set of metrics we could pick. What's the value of the system we want to design? And we need to kind of train people in thinking that way.
So I keep going back to kind of engineering how software is built. So Raid, so should we have the equivalent of unit tests for...
I think we have an equivalent requirements gathering, like before you even build it. Yeah, like we don't do requirements gathering in most of these, right? Because the way, again, if you go into industry, any real, you know, if you look at the public stuff, the research, everybody wants to build a general purpose thing that works for every single problem. And then when you go to actual implementation, it's this really finely tuned thing that does one thing really, really well. That doesn't get publicized. So I think that's kind of the challenge, is that we assume that the requirements are kind of the same for every system. Because as Andrew was saying, well, what does fairness mean?
But maybe when you're doing the equivalent of test-driven development for ML, some of your unit tests should be specifically geared towards some of this risk that Andrew is pointing to, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's a funny word that we use sometimes, and it scares people, but just ML assurance, which is, I don't know, and Patrick Hall, who co-founded BNH with me, has this wonderful line that you can't buy a microwave without a troubleshooting manual. And yet, you can buy, you know, $1 million ML model, and the documentation's not standard. Nobody knows who do you call, what do you do. And so there are a bunch of things going on, but I think just there's, you know, we're talking about fairness, even broader than fairness, when you think about just risk and performance. I think there's a world of opportunity just to, like, in the world of ML assurance. You've built this thing, you bet your company's future on it. How do you know that it works a month from now, 6 months from now, 12 months from now? And these are all questions that there just seems to be either no answers or answers that are not consistent.
But it seems like there are lessons. It's not, obviously ML is different than traditional software, but it seems like there would be lessons and overlap with the things that the progress that we've made in SRE and DevOps, right? So
absolutely. I mean, we've got, as you said, we've got unit tests, right? So we should be testing when you come up with a formulation, test that to see, is it what you wanted it to be? When you get the data, do a test on your data to figure out what the issues are. When you build something.
And that's just part of the workflow.
Exactly. And to Andrew's point, the artifacts that get generated during this are the standard documentation and package that comes along with this. You know, the model is not, you know, here's a piece of binary that you run, you give it input attributes and it features and gives you a score. The model is the entire pipeline with this process of how it was built, what data it used, how the choices were made, what values it was designed to do, how it was validated, how you continue to monitor it. That's the thing we need to provide, and not as a binary that gives you a score, because I don't know what to do with it.
Frankly, it's hard for Raid. It's hard for people who don't follow the fairness research closely to figure out, okay, there's a lot happening. There's a lot of libraries. What should we be doing? Because we're not experts in this, right? So,
I mean, to be fair, I think for now, at least for the tech teams, 80-90% of the effort is just awareness. It's not the tool, right? So today, they'll measure some metric. Let's for now assume it's correct.
Or run some of the simple tests that we've
done. That's right. And so a minimal thing you could do is take the same metric and break it down by different types of groups, right? Technically, it's not hard. It's going to take you another 2 minutes. It's kind of that awareness and thinking that what am I building, and what impact is it going to have on people? What can it be used for? Right? Because often in this case, like the bias we see comes, you know, it ends up coming from either the way you formulated the problem or the data that you used or the analysis pipeline that you built, that you made design choices that you didn't think, or the way it was used, right? You could have a perfectly fair ML model. And then let's say you're using it to do outreach to get people vaccinated. Let's say the outreach program is in English. It doesn't matter how fair your model is. The right, system right. will be unfair because of your... So without knowing how it's going to be used, you can't... So you have to kind of work backwards from, okay, what do you care about? Which is, let's say, equity in health outcomes through vaccinations. What action do you have? Which is outreach. And then you sort of think about the model and the metrics. So I think the tools are needed to make it part of the process, just embedded in your, as you're saying, is it's just part of your workflow. But I think in my mind, even putting those tools in automated checks makes you think about it. It makes you like, oh, it's asking me, what groups do I care about to configure this system? What groups do I care about? Or
And I guess the mindset that it's something that we need to add to basically every stage of the pipeline. So in other words, honestly, even the, you know, these model monitoring tools, right? So because basically when a model gets deployed, it starts acting with real users and live data.
Yeah.
This is another dimension that you should probably monitor.
Really? Absolutely. Yeah. Even sort of very simple. So I was at a workshop a few weeks ago around like linked data record, you know, and what I sort of brought up there was even things that we consider as, you know, pretty mundane, like record linkage. Like when you use these tools to integrate data, but, you know, so customer data or, you know, other people data and you link them, that system makes mistakes. Like sometimes it misses people and sometimes it mislinks people. Now, that's not random, right? So people who have long names with lots of consonants, and they often get, the data gets mislinked, and people with common names and who live on the main streets, they get linked with somebody else's data. And they can say, well, whatever. But then imagine what the ML model does. It misses information about them in one case, and it adds somebody else's information in the other case. And so you might deny somebody a loan because you thought they're not making enough money because you missed their job, or you might deny them a loan because they had some bankruptcy filing that you mislinked from somebody else's data. Right. So even that mundane record linkage thing that most of us just sort of use as a commodity, we pick it up, or we even get linked data and we don't know how it was linked. There's no documentation of that. So it's literally every piece of that pipeline needs to be kind of instrumented to think about its downstream equity and bias impact on people.
And Andrew is going to tell us that this is happening in most companies today, right?
It is not happening. But I just want to, you know, lest people who are listening get very overwhelmed by that, because going from where things are today to what Rayud said is a jump that might cause some data scientists to fall out of their chairs or
fall off
their...
Get used to it.
Yeah. But I think so. Just to be super concrete and practical, one very clear place to start is just standardizing documentation for what you're doing now. And like you said, just describing your assumptions.
That's one of the things that developers and data scientists love doing, Andrew, writing documentation.
I know, they love words. I know. Well, the truth is that I don't know how to make that, you know, I can make it a little bit less painless, which is to say that we see all the time, because there's such a high rate of turnover, when there's an issue with a model, some data scientist gets thrown in to try to fix it, and they have no idea what's going on because the person who built the model didn't document it well and has left. And so I think in some ways, it will make everyone's life easier if it's standardized. In other ways, you're absolutely right. And people don't become data scientists because they like writing things down in, you know, Word documents or, you know, Google Docs or whatever.
No, this is an important tip, but important point. Yeah.
Yeah. But so if I think, honestly, what I would say, I think it boils down to short-term versus long-term incentives. If short-term, you just want to build and train models and deploy them, you're right. Documentation feels like it's slowing you down. But if you care about what you're doing long-term, you want someone else to be able to fix something that's gone wrong. If there's an incident, there are always incidents, and someone needs to go in and troubleshoot or debug or whatever it is. If you are the only one that knows how the system works, you're going to get woken up in the middle of the night if you still work at that company. Or like, there are all of these reasons why it is long-term not in the best interest of data scientists and the models that they're deploying to not have what they do well documented. And so as a starting point, not the ideal state, but as a starting point, just documenting what's going on, what your assumptions are, how you've addressed even minimal bias concerns can really go like a very long way. Like it will make a huge difference, even though it doesn't seem like a lot. So not all of these solutions need to be intimidating, even if there's a lot of work to do.
So we've talked a lot about fairness. So Andrew, in your mind, what are the top two things in terms of risk? Is it fairness and privacy? So fairness, privacy, and security, those are
learning systems. You're asking a lawyer to limit the answer to two. I'll tell you what we, so the major issues, we see four major issues, and then I will choose from those and give you two. But we see fairness, security, privacy, and transparency or explainability. So those four all intersect in all these really funky ways. Interestingly,
transparency is more of partly compliance, right? So you're asked to have models that are explainable.
Right? It's actually, I would think of it. So I gave four things. Transparency would be the umbrella that sits above all of them, because if you don't know what your model's doing, it's hard to secure it. It's hard to make sure it's private. It's hard to make sure you can't do incident response if you don't know what's happening.
So that's most of ML right now, deep learning.
Yeah, but transparency isn't equal to explainability.
Yeah.
Right? Just because I can build a totally complex machine learning model and print it out for you. The equations I can print out, it's totally transparent. Good luck explaining or understanding what it just did. Right. Right? Good luck doing incident response. So I think transparency is a goal in itself for other reasons, for, you know, but it doesn't often, it may not lead to, I think, you know, to Andrew's point, it's not for the sake of transparency. Right? You have to kind of define transparency in a way that supports these other goals.
I see.
It's sort of the other thing to sort of, you know, just to keep this in context, right? We're talking about most decisions today in the world are made by these things called humans, with very little transparency, with very little explainability, with very little fairness, and with very little documentation. So should we come up with this? I mean, it's a different conversation, but should we come up with the same rules for humans as they exist for machines? Should every judge have to have the same bias tests done today as we're asking these algorithms to do? And I'd argue yes, because what's the difference?
Great. That would be great. Also, I feel compelled, Ben. You asked me to say two things. So I need to, I think you're right. So I think fairness is number one. And I think privacy impacts all of these models in ways that are really just extremely significant, in ways that are obvious and not. But one of the things that I want to make sure to talk about real world incidents, but the FTC has started to do something they're calling algorithmic disgorgement, which is a wonderful term, where basically they're telling companies they have to disgorge their models. They can't use them. They have to go out of production. And EverAlbum is a very high profile example of this, where they built a model on data that was not compliant from a privacy perspective, and regulators basically killed the model. I mean, it had a huge, huge impact on the company. So I think fairness is what you see the most in the news. Privacy also, and then there are lots of issues. It's hard to choose, but I think those are the two.
Yeah, there was a book that I liked. I don't know. I think I told you about this book, The Ethical Algorithm, Andrew, by Michael Kearns. And there, they kind of look through the kind of research literature, and they kind of evaluate which of these areas are most ready in terms of tools and techniques. And actually, privacy is the area they kind of chose as in many ways, because of differential privacy and related techniques, as prime for something for companies to be able to act on, right?
No. I mean, so this is a really good, it's probably a tangent that we can come back to someday.
Yeah.
But think of what differential privacy is doing, right? The trade-offs we're looking at is against some global accuracy metric.
Right.
What's happening? So right now, the big fiasco happening with the Census Bureau, right? They decided they were going to use differential privacy to release data. Now, the trade-off that happens is they're looking at global trade-offs. But what happens is that small groups, underrepresented groups, small communities that were relying on that data to make decisions around resource allocation are going to get total crap. They're going to get data that is useless for them. So it depends again on the values, right? So it's almost, if we look at differential privacy as it's being used today, it gives you guarantees on the privacy side, but it throws away all, you know, it doesn't give you anything around the fairness on the systems that are going to be built using that data. And I think we need to kind of look at that solution more holistically and say, what are the values again that we want? So I think using differential privacy it's a solved problem. We should start using it is a risky thing to do if you care about equity and fairness.
Yeah. My impression is what they were saying is that you can use it, but in the way that you describe, which is basically in conjunction with, you know, as long as you know what you're optimizing. right? So
Raed is right. I'm a fan of differential privacy, but I think it needs to have a very tailored use case. I think there are some, you can tell me, Raed, if you think I'm wrong here, but I think there are some documented examples where the type of noise insertion that differential privacy uses can actually make models perform better across different demographic groups. So it's using differential privacy intelligently can actually make models more fair when they're being trained on limited training data. So anyway, I think I'm excited about it. And also it can be very problematic, would probably be the right way of saying it.
Yeah. I don't think it's a cure-all, but it's a step forward to at least that one area. Right. So,
yeah, no, I think we just have to kind of think about, like, when we think about these again, privacy utility curves, what's our definition of utility? And for every use case, it's a different definition. So,
Yeah,
exactly. If your goal is, X, then maybe this works. If your goal is Y, you try it. And as you said, it's not a cure all. It shouldn't be thought of as all privacy problems are now solved because we have differential privacy. It's a really great advance. But again, use it in an informed way, just like anything else.
By the way, Raed, in my conversations with Andrew, this notion of ML and AI in general is becoming increasingly interdisciplinary, right? So in other words, you need to work with UX people,
lawyers.
Yeah.
Great.
And then honestly, machine learning people will not like this, but you need to work with statisticians and economists because they know experimental design.
I don't think you'd be surprised how I think a lot of fields have been teaching their students that they're self-sufficient to solve any problem in the world. Yeah, they think that econ is probably the field that's started that.
Yeah.
Machine learning is getting there. And of course, that's not true, right? And so the obvious connections are, of course, on the social science side, because they know that they're looking at causal inference issues, they know experimental design, they're looking at data is not something that God gave you. Data is an artifact that's produced by some process, but you have to, lawyers are in the fold because eventually we have to change law and be within the law. Philosophy and ethics are there. But I think that the part that we were having a conversation yesterday in a workshop around humanities, what's the role of sort of people in the humanities? And I think that's still, there's a lot of work between ML people and social science people and economists and sociologists and law and ethics. But I think that's one area where I think we have to sort of, there are some strides to make in both directions, but also it's exciting because computer scientists, are interested in those questions. They just don't know how to think about them because we don't have training in our disciplines.
So I wonder, Andrew, if at some point, you start seeing some of these teams inside companies to have people from really diverse backgrounds, right?
Yeah.
Not just culturally diverse, but academically diverse, right?
Yeah. I mean, there are all sorts of ways to think about diversity. So background, experience, expertise. The one thing I will flag, and I start to get concerned, and I have the same kind of alarm bell going off when people, go deep into AI ethics, which is that if you're Google or Apple and you have unlimited money, it's not hard to say like, yeah, sure, I want every machine learning team should have a sociologist. I'll take one of those. This is a conversation that literally like big tech companies can afford and maybe only them. And so frequently what we see, we go into smaller companies or even startups, they say, that sounds great, but I have X amount. It needs to last me Y amount of time and I need to get a product out the door. And so I always think that like, even though it's great and certainly in how data scientists are trained and even lawyers are trained, it's really important. But I think what can be really hard and what almost can help turn a lot of data scientists and companies off of this is they just say, that's not practical kind of the end. And so to ensure that it's clear that this can be practical, there are all sorts of different ways that you can incorporate diversity and diverse experience into teams, even if there's a lot of pressure just to like build things quickly. And so it doesn't have to be a full-time person. It can have some, can be an outside consultation. It can literally just be, if you're creating documentation, having a section for like how someone else might look for this. There are all sorts of creative ways to basically, I think the big message is if you are only optimizing for accuracy and speed and time to market, you're gonna miss things. And so there are all sorts of ways to stop and pause and think about like what other types of perspective can be inserted into this process.
One positive thing, and Raed might want to weigh in here as well, is that as these techniques get more democratized, like he said, like Raid said, right? So to train models, it's two lines of code, you know, or one line of code in scikit-learn.
To load the data and then train the model. So yeah. That's two lines. Yeah.
So these are getting democratized. So honestly, I'm starting to see people from other disciplines get trained in using these tools. So it could well be that you don't actually, your team is just diverse because your UX person actually knows a little bit of these things or the social scientist on your team knows ML, right? So
and a lot of do, like my team, generally had a combination of all these different disciplines and yeah, everybody is doing the technique. It's not as if, the social scientists are pondering over questions and then the CS people are writing code. Everybody is self-sufficient or should be to think about the spectrum. But also think that to Andrew's point, right? Today, again, a lot of the training we're giving these different disciplines isn't shared. So they don't have a shared vocabulary, which leads to, it's not an efficient process to bring all of them together, right? Because for the first long time, they're going to speak over each other. They're not going to see the value of each other. And so I think, again, I would push a lot of this work on the universities and say, hey, do your job and train them. The other thing I think I do want to mention is, we talk about disciplinary diversity, but I also think that we're talking about all these systems that are affecting everybody in the world, right? So the diversity in the teams has to sort of reflect the diversity of the problems and the people. And I think that's a bigger issue facing, we can get social scientists, but we're not getting people who have experience living with the problems that we're using these, building these systems to tackle. And I think that's a huge issue right now. And I think for a lot of this bias and these hypothetical questions for a lot of people with the experience, lived experience, it's a very real question that they've dealt with. So I think that's another opportunity for us as a field. They don't need us.
Don't get me started on Facebook in the Philippines.
Well, that's where all their content reviewers probably sit, right?
Anyway, so Andrew, the list of examples you sent me around fairness were interesting, but also still kind of not as commonplace as I would imagine, right? So, like on a hourly basis, you're interacting with ML, but they're not the kind of ML systems on your list, for example, right? So
yeah. It's the problem, and so for background, so I sent you, Ben, a list of some incidents that I think shed light into how these failures happen, these fairness failures happen in ML in the real world. The problem, and this is actually a lot like, I think there's a very good analog to what happened with cybersecurity about 10 or so years ago, which is that all these systems are failing, but the only public incidents that we have are the ones that you see about on Twitter or that get discovered or they get written about. And so what we have to talk about publicly and that you can actually read about are kind of the more extreme examples, exactly like you mentioned, like the tip of the iceberg.
And then the ones that you work with, since you're a lawyer, you can't really talk about.
Exactly, yeah. And so what happened with cybersecurity is starting in the 2000s, people systems became breached a lot, and there were huge hacks, but nobody talked about them publicly, and it was kind of something that happens behind the curtain, and there was no incentive to release any information about it. And then about 10 or so years ago, a bunch of data breach laws came on the books where if you were breached as a company, you had to disclose. There were mandatory disclosure periods. And so that has made the environment for cybersecurity a lot more open. And now it's clear the extent to which this is a problem. Right now, there's absolutely no reason to talk about an ML failure unless the media has already written about it. And so we're in this situation where like the clients that BNH reports, hopefully the work that we're doing is never going to be public because, clients, what clients are trying to do is control it, minimize the damage and then move on. And we as a law firm, of course, are obligated to do what's in their best interest. So we're in this funny situation where all of these incidents are happening, but what we can actually talk about and read about.
Shared knowledge.
Yeah.
And actually, Raid, I don't know how you feel about this, but when we talk about ML, we always talk, we always conjure production ML, right? So something that gets deployed. But I mean, I think inside companies, there's a lot of one-off ML where you think you have a problem, you apply a model and you're done. But somehow that application of that model once or twice is impactful, right?
Yeah. No, I think that's a good point. It's like, there are no regulations. Like when you have customer data breach, there are regulations that force you to disclose that and then compensate people. there is no such thing for racism or sexism or, you know, any bias in human or, I mean, unless you get litigated or, you know, it's somebody complains. And so the reason a lot of these, you know, I'm sure there are infinitely more incidents happening. We just don't find out about them. And more importantly, probably those organizations deploying and using the models don't find out about them. It just sort of, you know, a bias tree falls in somewhere and you know, nobody hears it. Right.
So there's no, Andrew, this is something we talked about. There's no black hat or DEFCON for.
There is a bias bounty type, have been bias bounty type programs. Not very widespread, but I think.
But a gathering.
Social
gathering, right? So.
There should be one. Yes, we've talked about it. I think there needs to be. I actually have heard that DEF CON might be introducing some more of this year. But yes, there needs to. I think right now, I feel like it's like a nascent community. But like as AI gets more adopted, it's going to be broader.
Talk about a diverse community. Cybersecurity, I don't think they're the most diverse.
Yeah. Yes. Well, yeah. I cut my teeth in the cybersecurity world. Yeah. That was actually my entrance into the tech world.
Yeah.
And the one thing I will say is because, and it's actually one of the things that's the most fun about information security is because it's not a discipline. There are even like the education, the academic institutions, like you don't, it's very hard to get like, there are actually a bunch of certifications, but it's hard and the certifications have cropped up. Anyway, the point is that if you look at the people who are the leaders in the field of cybersecurity, they come from all sorts of different backgrounds, having studied all of these different random things. And so it's fascinating because there's actually not anything that makes someone good at information security, other than maybe like an aversion for eye contact.
Is it possible? Do you foresee the possibility that this might evolve as just a sub-community inside cyber? You know, like the people who attack ML systems or, you know, so ML risk becomes kind of a sub-community inside these larger cyber communities. Is that possible?
I want to let Raed go.
I mean, Andrew is part of that. You know, I don't have enough experience to have an informed.
All right. So I think the real question is it depends on how much money is in it. This is like a very reductionist set, but like I think cybersecurity is big so problem. Interesting because suddenly there's a huge amount of money in this problem that it wasn't clear what you need. You just have to be interested in like learning crazy stuff and new stuff. And so I think it attracted a lot of really interesting, quirky folks. And I hope that in the future, companies and governments will incentivize people to really specialize in this. And I think if the incentives are there, absolutely. And I think it'll be really interesting.
Because in many ways, like you said, it's risk, but it's ML risk. But the cyber people, that's what they do, right? So mitigate.
Yeah, but the thing is, I mean, the amount we pay for cybersecurity, like we collectively, is staggering. You can almost think of there's some tax. I don't know what it is, but every time you buy some software product, part of that goes to fund cybersecurity efforts, which sadly, our information security is still terrible.
You talk with chief legal officers. So where do they think this capability should fall under? ML risk.
I mean, there are a bunch of different ways that this is playing into practice. I think the natural place for this is security or legal or both, because these are places that have authority and budget and know how to do this. There are other models where ML risk gets cordoned off to a separate standalone team. It happened at Airbnb. As in one of the incidents I sent you is that they created a separate ML team and they did really good work. But because they were so isolated, they didn't have enough resources or headcount actually, or maybe even authority to do what they needed to do. So nobody knows and everyone is trying something different. To make it a little bit more optimistic though, the same thing is still true with privacy and, you know, look, different, the chief privacy officer, some of them are actually not even lawyers. They report to different people. So it's still kind of shaking out.
So Raed, in the public sphere, how is it playing out in the public policy world?
I think, I mean, I'm going to jump back quickly to the cyber analogy. And I think one difference is in security and privacy, in a lot of cases, there is an adversarial game going on. And that's partially what makes it really expensive because you're always, you know, there is arguably intelligent people on both sides in playing this game. Whereas in the bias world, it's mostly incompetence that's leading to bias, which might be harder to guard against because there is no cure for that. But I think that's a big distinction is most of these incidents that, you know, Andrew put out at OBC, you know, whether it's around criminal justice or on hiring decision or around allocating money for healthcare, or most of these mistakes were not because, you know, somebody deliberately put that in there. It was pure incompetence. It's not thinking about what you're trying to build, not designing to those values, not having the right process and the right tools. So I think it's cheaper to guard against that, because a one-off will get you 70% of the way. And then you'll keep updating and keeping up to date, but you don't have a fully adversarial system that's fighting against you. And in the, you know, your question of sort of in the public policy world, where does it live? There's sort of, I would think like there are two types of public policy worlds, right? One is sort of policy for tech, right? So how should these be regulated? How should they be monitored? What are the reporting guidelines when you do this work? The second is tech for policy, right? So how do we use the systems to do better allocation of human services, better allocation of health services? And I think in that world, some of the struggles are the values are somewhat aligned, in this case at least, where you know everybody agrees on what needs to be done. But there is a gap, there's a skill gap, right? We don't have enough people who come in with these skills, who have experience, people who understand the domain, don't have the tech skills, and the tech people coming in just want to build a website and, you know, break things. And I think that there is sort of this lack of kind of, you know, again, people working together in these things. So I think that there is less sort of the 100-person, you know, machine learning team that's screwing up. It's more there's a 2-person data team that's doing everything. And one risk, so one thing I see often in this right now is people are reading some of these research publications coming out and these, you know, New York Times and Wired articles and saying, oh shit, machine learning or AI is biased, so we shouldn't use it. And that's dangerous, right? Because that's assuming the status quo world is perfect. That's not, nobody's racist, nobody's sexist, everything is just perfect. And adding these machines can only make things worse as opposed to doing it the right way. So I think that's something we spend a lot of time with government agencies is, no. There's a way to do this right. Your conclusion shouldn't be machine learning is biased or racist. Hence, we should not use any data and keep with our, you know, human gut intuition based methods.
Interesting. Yeah, no. As you pointed out, right? So the old way of doing things has a lot of problems too, you know? And just because this new modern way has problems doesn't mean you just write it off completely.
Yeah, and that's what you compare it with. I think that's one thing a lot of people forget is when they measure these systems, they're measuring against perfection as opposed to the status quo. Can we do better than the status quo? It's a good starting point. It's not a good ending point.
Right. And by the way, so we're having this discussion in the U.S., in the context of the U.S., and obviously Europe is moving faster in some ways, maybe slower in other ways, but there's also the rest of the world outside of U.S. and Europe, right? So APAC, massive adopters of data and machine learning technologies. I think one of the things that's underappreciated in the U.S. a little bit is that they're just as concerned about some of these issues as we are, right? So there's the stereotype that, for example, the Chinese don't care about privacy. Well, that's not actually true. they do care about these issues as well. But no, so it'll be interesting to see how much of this is driven by researchers in the West and how much the rest of the world can impact some of these efforts. And Raid, you probably talk to people from all over the world about these issues as well, right? So
yeah, no, I mean, they're certainly extremely concerned. I think one benefit they have is they don't have as much of a pre-built infrastructure as people do in the US and sort of Western Europe. And so they don't have to replicate, they don't have to kind of do some of those things from legacy things. They can build the right infrastructure. And I think that's where they're thinking through a lot of countries.
That's great.
Now, that being said, I think things, you know, I'll give you a simple example. A couple of years ago, we're working with Jakarta around looking at sort of fatal traffic accidents. And they had put in a bunch of these cameras to monitor traffic and, you know, ethical and privacy issues aside for 2 seconds. When we sort of applied existing vision algorithms to detect traffic objects that are built in the US, it couldn't detect anything. They didn't really have a category for motorcycles with, you know, bags to carry all sorts of stuff. It didn't have a category for food cart vendors on the street. It didn't have, you know, cars going the wrong way repeatedly. So again, a lot of these technologies, there are some general purpose stuff, but then it needs to be kind of customized to the local needs. And that means that you can't just take here what's been built and just transferred over, you need the local talent and the local work to happen. And we have to kind of figure out how to support that, right? Because there isn't, the training infrastructure isn't there. But I think it's that certainly they're concerned about all the same things as people are here.
And to close, Andrew, so you gave a great tip about, start with documentation. So what other closing advice would you want to give?
So I would say start and end with documentation. Documentation is the most practical place to focus in our experience, because there are all sorts of different teams that need to get involved to do this right. And if you're just doing something in the code, it's a lot harder to have legal review it. It's a lot harder to have everybody come kind of into a meeting, with the same artifact. So there are a whole host of reasons why, if you can get that right, especially if you can just standardize, what does it mean to have a system documented?
So is this something that BNH is putting out material?
Yes, it is. This is something, thank you for asking. This is something that we help a lot of our clients with. It's interestingly, one of the first things that we'll help with for just specific models. And then we will work with clients as they stand up an AI governance system, a holistic system. What is your standard documentation template? And we will build those for our clients. So it's really, 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 and the reason why I'm harping on it is because in terms of effort to impact, it's actually not that much effort to say, these are the sections that need to be filled in for every model, however many pages it is for the organization. It doesn't take that much effort. And if everyone actually does it, you can make a huge amount of progress. And from a legal defensibility standpoint, even if your systems aren't perfect, you can do a lot. So in terms of effort to impact, I think it is the highest value place that, the Googles of the world and, the 10-person startups can really make a lot of progress on this issue.
And with that, thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Quick reminder, we have two new surveys that will be released shortly. The first is the NLP Industry Survey, and the second one is the Data Engineering Survey. If you want a copy of these free reports, please subscribe to our newsletter at gradientflow.com/subscribe. If you have suggestions as far as books, conferences, links, and guests to book on the podcast, please visit our website, thedataexchange.media, and fill out the contact form there. You can follow Rayid Ghani and Andrew Burt on Twitter at Rayid Ghani and at NBurt. Thanks for joining us. If you like the show, please subscribe and rate us through Apple Podcasts or Stitcher or TuneIn.com or Spotify and never miss an episode. The Data Exchange Podcast is a property of Gradient Flow. And I will be back next week, and we will do this all over again.